The king energy is primordial in all men. It bears the same relationship to the other three mature masculine potentials as the divine child does to the other three immature masculine energies. It comes first in importance, and it underlies and includes the rest of the archetypes in perfect balance. The good and generative king is also a good warrior, a positive magician, and a great lover. And yet, with most of us, the king comes online last. We could say that the king is the divine child, but seasoned and complex, wise and in a sense as selfless as the divine child is cosmically self-involved. Whereas the divine child, especially in his aspect as the high chair tyrant, has infantile pretensions to godhood, the king archetype comes close to being God in his masculine form within every man. In many ways, the king energy is father energy. It is our experience, however, that although the king underlies the father archetype, as Freud defined it, it is more extensive and more basic than the father. Historically, kings have always been sacred. As mortal men, however, they have been relatively unimportant. It is the kingship, or the king energy itself, that has been important. As Sir James Frazier and others have observed, kings in the ancient world were often ritually killed when their ability to live out the king archetype began to fail. What was important was that the generative power of the energy not be tied to the fate of an aging and increasingly impotent mortal. With the raising up of the new king, the king energy was re-embodied, and the king as archetype was renewed in the lives of the people of the realm. In fact, the whole world was renewed. This pattern, the ritual killing and reviving, is what lies behind the Christian story of the death and resurrection of Christ, the Savior King. Earlier, we said that the death of the archetypes of boyhood, and especially of the hero, was the birth of the man, that the end of boy psychology is the beginning of man psychology. Two functions of king energy make this transition from boy psychology to man psychology possible. The first of these is ordering. The second is the providing of fertility and blessing. Like the divine child, the good king is at the center of the world. He sits on his throne on the central mountain, or on the primeval hill, as the ancient Egyptians called it. And from this central place, all of creation radiates in geometrical form out to the very frontiers of the realm. World is defined as that part of reality that is organized and ordered by the king. What is outside the boundaries of his influence is non-creation, chaos, the demonic, and non-world. In conjunction with his ordering function, the second vital good that the king energy manifests is fertility and blessing. As the mortal king went, so did the realm, both its order and fertility. If the king was lusty and vigorous sexually, the land would be vital. If he stayed healthy and strong, the crops would grow, the cattle would reproduce, the merchants would prosper, and many babies would be born to his people. Always, the king's culminating, ordering, generative act was to marry the land in the form of his primary queen. It was only in creative partnership with her that he could assure every kind of bounty for his kingdom. It was the royal couple's duty to pass their creative energies on to the kingdom in the form of children. The kingdom would mirror the royal generativity, which, let us remember, was at the center. As the center was, so would be the rest of creation. When a king became sick or weak or impotent, the kingdom languished. The rains did not come. The crops did not grow. The cattle did not reproduce. Drought would assault the land, and the people would perish. So the king was the earthly conduit from the divine world, the world of the king energy, to this world. He was the mediator between the mortal and the divine. He was the central artery, we might say, that allowed the blood of the life force to flow into the human world. It was not only fertility in an immediately physical sense, or generativity and creativity in a general sense, that came out of the second function of the king energy through the efficacy of ancient kings. It was also blessing. Blessing is a psychological or spiritual event. The good king always mirrored and affirmed those others who deserved it. He did this by seeing them, in a literal sense, in his audiences at the palace, and in the psychological sense of noticing them, knowing them in their true worth. He held audience primarily not to be seen, but to see, admire, and delight in his subjects, to reward them, and to bestow honors upon them. Being blessed has tremendous psychological consequences for us. There are even studies that show that our bodies actually change chemically when we feel valued, praised, and blessed. Young men today are starving for blessing from older men, starving for blessing from the king energy. This is why they cannot, as we say, get it together. They need to be blessed. They need to be seen by the king. Because if they are, something inside will come together for them. That is the effect of blessing. It heals and makes whole. That's what happens when we are seen and valued for our legitimate talents and abilities. Of course, many ancient kings, like many men in kingly positions today, fell far short of the ideal image of the good king. Yet this central archetype lives on independently of any one of us and seeks, through us, to come into our lives in order to consolidate, create, and bless. What can we say are the characteristics of the good king? Based on ancient myths and legends, what are the qualities of this mature masculine energy? The king archetype in its fullness possesses the qualities of order, of reasonable and rational patterning, of integration and integrity in the masculine psyche. It gives stability and centeredness. It brings calm. It brings maintenance and balance. It defends our own sense of inner order, our integrity of being and of purpose, our essential certainty in our masculine identity. It looks upon the world with a firm but kindly eye. It sees others in all their weaknesses and in all their talent and worth. It guides them and nurtures them toward their own fullness of being. It rewards and encourages creativity in us and in others. In its central incorporation and expression of the warrior, it represents aggressive might when that is what is needed, when order is threatened. It also has the power of inner authority. This is the energy that seeks peace and stability, orderly growth and nurturing for all people. And not only for all people, but for the environment, the natural world. The king cares for the whole realm and is the steward of nature as well as of human society. This is the energy manifested in ancient myths of the shepherd of his people and of the gardener and husbandman of the plants and animals in the kingdom. This is the voice that affirms the human rights of all, that minimizes punishment and maximizes praise. This is the voice from the center, the primeval hill within every man. Though most of us have experienced some of this energy of the mature masculine in our lives, perhaps within ourselves in moments when we felt very well integrated, calm, and centered, most of us have to confess that we have experienced very little of the king energy in its fullness. We may have felt it in bits and pieces, but the sad fact is that this positive energy is disastrously lacking in the lives of most men. Mostly what we have experienced is what we are calling the Shadow King. As in the case of all the archetypes, the king displays an active-passive bipolar shadow structure. We call the active pole of the Shadow King the tyrant, and the passive pole the weakling. We can see the tyrant acting in the Christian story of the birth of Jesus. Soon after the Christ child is born, King Herod discovers the fact. He sends his soldiers to Bethlehem looking for the new king to kill it. Because Jesus is the divine child, he gets away in time. But Herod's soldiers kill every male child left in the town. Whenever the new is born, the Herod within us and in our outer lives will attack. The tyrant hates, fears, and envies new life because that new life, he senses, is a threat to his slim grasp on his own kingship. The tyrant king is not in the center and does not feel calm and generative. He is not creative, but only destructive. If he were secure in his own generativity and in his own inner order, his self-structures, he would react with delight at the birth of new life in his realm. The tyrant exploits and abuses others. He is ruthless, merciless, and without feeling when he is pursuing what he thinks is his own self-interest. His degradation of others knows no bounds. He hates all beauty, all innocence, all strength, all talent, all life energy. He does so because, as we've said, he lacks inner structure, and he is afraid, terrified, really, of his own hidden weakness and his underlying lack of potency. It is the Shadow King as tyrant in the Father who makes war on his sons and his daughters joy and newness of being and the life force surging through them, and he seeks to kill it. He does this with open verbal assaults and deprecation of their interests, hopes, and talents, or he does it alternately by ignoring their accomplishments, turning his back on their disappointments, and registering boredom and lack of interest when, for instance, they come home from school and present him with a piece of artwork or a good grade on a test. His attacks may not be limited to verbal or psychological abuse. Spankings may turn into beatings, and there may be sexual assaults as well. The father possessed by the tyrant may sexually exploit his daughters or even his sons' weakness and vulnerability. The tyrant king manifests in all of us at some time or another when we feel pushed to the limit, when we are exhausted, when we are getting inflated. But we can see it operating most of the time in certain personality configurations, most notably in the so-called narcissistic personality disorder. These people really feel that they are the center of the universe, although they aren't centered themselves, and that others exist to serve them. Instead of mirroring others, they insatiably seek mirroring from them. Instead of seeing others, they seek to be seen by them. The man possessed by the tyrant is very sensitive to criticism, and though putting on a threatening front, will at the slightest remark feel weak and deflated. He won't show you this, however. What you will see, unless you know what to look for, is rage. But under the rage is a sense of worthlessness, of vulnerability and weakness, for behind the tyrant lies the other pole of the king's bipolar shadow system, the weakling. If he can't be identified with the king energy, he feels he is nothing. The hidden presence of this passive pole explains the hunger for mirroring, for adore me, worship me, see how important I am, that we feel from so many of our superiors and friends. This explains their angry outbursts and their attacks on those they see as weak, that is, those upon whom they project their own inner weakling. The man possessed by the weakling lacks centeredness, calmness, and security within himself, and this also leads him into paranoia. The man possessed by the bipolar shadow king has much to fear, in fact, because his oppressive behaviors, often including cruelty, beg for an in-kind response from others. A defensive, hostile, get-them-before-they-get-you paranoia is destructive of one's own character and that of others, and invites retaliation. We can readily see the tyrant's relationship to the high chair tyrant, rising as he does out of this infantile pattern. Grandiosity is normal, in a certain way, in the divine child. It is appropriate for the divine child, like the baby Jesus, to want and need to be adored, even by kings. What parents need to do, and this is very difficult, is give the divine child in their own child just the right amount of adoration and affirmation, so that they can let their human child down off the high chair easily, gradually into the real world, where gods cannot live as mortal humans. The parents need to help their human baby boy learn gradually not to identify with the divine child. If they adore him too much and don't help the baby boy's ego form outside of the archetype, then he may never get down from his high chair. Inflated with the power of the high chair tyrant, he will simply cross into adulthood thinking he is Caesar. If we challenge a person like this and say to him, "My God, you think you're Caesar?" he may very well say, "Yeah, what about it?" This is one way the Shadow King gets formed in men. The other way the Shadow King is formed is when the parents have abused the baby boy and attacked his grandiosity and gloriousness from the beginning. The grandiosity of the divine child, high chair tyrant, then gets split off and dropped into the boy's unconscious for safekeeping. The boy may, as a consequence, come under the power of the weakling prince. Later, when he is an adult and functioning primarily under the dominance of the weakling, under the enormous pressures of the adult world, his repressed grandiosity may explode to the surface, completely raw and primitive, completely unmodulated and very powerful. This is the man who seemed cool-headed and rational and nice, but who, once he's been promoted, suddenly becomes a different person. A little Hitler. This is the man for whom the saying, "Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely," is entirely accurate.